You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today after 7, it's the Moth Radio Hour. Among tonight's stories, a literary woman sparks a romance with a New York City fireman, and Jim Beam's great-grandson describes growing up under the watchful eye of his famous Kentucky bourbon family. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, the Vietnam War and military interventions in Cambodia and Laos stretched over a decade, but the years 1969 and 1970 were both a climax and turning point of the anti-war movement and police and government reactions to it.
While the nation as a whole was in turmoil, Wisconsin played a high-profile role in both protests against the war and a rejection of violent means to end it. Do you remember that period? Were you here in Wisconsin then in 1969, 1970? What's your memory of how the mood in the state and the country changed in those years? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Clara Bingham has written a sprawling history of those two pivotal years through a series of first-person interviews that she conducted. The book is Witness to the Revolution: Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul. Clara, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you decide to write specifically about August 1969 through August 1970?
Well, I missed it. I was born in 1963, so I was just, I was very young during the late part of the 60s. But it was such an important part of my life because I grew up in New York City on Central Park West, and my playground was the staging ground for so many different protest movements in the late 60s and early 70s. And so I realized that my life had really changed because of the 60s. I could study it at any college and have any job that I wanted, partly because of all these different protest movements, but that I really didn't understand, why everything had changed so quickly. And I wanted to look back now when people are into their 60s and 70s who were activists during that time and talk to them about what they did in the late 60s and get a sense of why those years were so crucial to changing who we are as a country. So I decided to go on an adventure, and I spent about 3 years traveling around the country interviewing. In the end, it was 100 activists who took part in different parts of the movement for social change.
And in the title of your book, you reference radicals, resistors, vets, and hippies. How did those groups shape that period, particularly that period at the very end of the 1960s?
Well, I decided to focus on the school year of 69-70 because I felt that that was really the crescendo of the 60s. It was a time when so much social unrest took place, and there was a huge student strike that took place after the Kent State shootings, which were in May. And after that, 2.5 million students in 700 colleges didn't go back to school. And we really came as close as we ever had to a civil war. I mean, there was just a massive generational massive generational gap going on. And so I wanted to talk to people who are in different parts of the movement. And so I talked to radicals who were part of SDS, the Student for Democratic Society, that then split off and some of them became the Weathermen. I talked to resistors who were draft resistors, people like David Harris, who started a organization called The Resistance, and hundreds of thousands of people resisted the draft, young men at the time. And then also to vets. Many Vietnam vets came back from the war by 69 and 70 and became involved in the anti-war movement. And then, of course, hippies, who were part of the cultural change that was going on at the time. So all of these different groups were very, very active in the late 60s. And so it really created a perfect storm of protest.
And so let's talk about that academic year, as you said, and it does make a lot of sense because so much activity was going on the college campuses around the country. Let's zero in specifically on Wisconsin. What did your interviews tell you about what was going on in Wisconsin in the latter part of 69 to start with?
Well, a lot. I mean, Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin-Madison was one of the most radical and violent campuses in the country. And I decided that, you know, everyone had heard about what had happened at Berkeley and Columbia and even Harvard. But in fact, Madison, what happened at Madison was more important. And there was a student protest that lasted for years and years there. I mean, the National Guard practically moved on to campus. And one of the first protests that began, the whole protest, student protest movement, was at Madison in October of 1967, when about 300 students staged a sit-in in protest of Dow Chemical, the manufacturer of napalm that at the time was recruiting students to go and work for them, and also the university was involved in research for Dow Chemical. And so that particular protest was extremely violent because the Madison police force came down very strong and beat all of the protesters who were peaceful at the time with billy clubs, and there was a lot of blood and a lot of hospitalization, and it really radicalized the rest of the campus, excuse me, because they witnessed so much brutality. And it kind of kicked off another 2 to 3 years of intensive, constant protest. So I interviewed several members of student members who were involved at the time in Madison. And it was really fascinating to hear how so many parts of that campus were really erupting. Later on in 69, there was something called the Mifflin Street riot, where police went into Mifflin Street, which was a part of the campus where a lot of the countercultural and political students lived, and beat everybody up, threw tear gas out, and it was a very intensive and violent moment, few days. And so I talked to policemen who were involved in that riot, and then students who were there, and so it was fascinating to try to paint a portrait of what was going on in Madison at that time.
We're talking with Clara Bingham about her new book, Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul. Well, let's talk a little more about who was being caught up in these anti-war protests, or people that were supporting the government, whether they were in an official capacity like police or like National Guard or just members of the public. You talk about those very distinct groups, and those are often the groups that you see in photos and hear from in histories. But what was the general mood of the public, maybe not people who were involved in college campuses, but, you know, out in the rest of the state, out in the rest of the country?
Well, I mean, there was, of course, the country was very deeply divided, and President Nixon, who was elected in 1968, called his supporters the silent majority. We've been hearing that that phrase because Trump has been using it as well. And Nixon did have a majority following him. Ultimately, he was reelected in 1972 in a landslide. So, certainly the older people who were over 30, tended to support Nixon and were very much against the young hippies who were taking to the streets and changing not just the political realm, but also the social realm. So there was so much going on. There was the beginning of feminism and gay rights. There was, you know, lots of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And so it seemed as if the country was really coming apart at its seams. And many Americans were very threatened by this, and it was scary. There was a deep divide between the youth generation, and this was, of course, the beginning of the baby boom. For example, in 1964, college enrollment increased by 37%. So it was the beginning of the post-World War II baby boom generation. There were a lot of them then. And they became involved in the civil rights movement in the early to mid-60s. And then, of course, the Vietnam War and the draft picked up by 1965. And so students who had begun organizing in the early part of the decade then became very organized against the war. And so the country was divided, but Madison was this one important campus where the students were very radicalized. And it was interesting because about 50% of the undergraduates, one-third of the undergraduates were from out of state at that time, and 50% of the graduates were from out of state. So it was unusual for a state university to have so many out-of-state students. And I think that had something to do with why Madison was so radical at the time.
So in some ways, it was a microcosm. We're talking with Claire Bingham about her new book, Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your memories of the events of 1969 and 1970? Were you one of the radicals, resistors, vets, and hippies that our guest is writing about? Were you there at protests, watching, participating? On the police force? Were you watching from elsewhere in the state, elsewhere in the country? What did you think watching what was going on? What did you think of the war in Vietnam? How did things change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation now with Clara Bingham. Her new book is Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where were you in those pivotal years, 1969, 1970? Were you protesting the war? Were you serving in the military? What did you think of what was going on in those pivotal years? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Clara, certainly one of the most significant events in that year that you write about and here in Wisconsin was the bombing of Sterling Hall on the UW-Madison campus, which occurred in the early hours of August 24th, 1970. Why was Sterling Hall a focus of the anti-war movement?
Sterling Hall, which is also called the Army Mass Research Center, was the building where a lot of the research for Dow Chemical took place. So it was a science center where the Department of Defense had contracts out to the University of Wisconsin for studies that most likely had to do with napalm and other weapons that were being used in the Vietnam War. And so the Daily Cardinal, the very popular student newspaper that was also quite investigative and influential, had published a series of articles in 1969 and 70 about the connections between the university and General Electric and Dow Chemical and all of this research that was going on at the Army Math Research Center or Sterling Hall. So that building became symbolic, in a sense, of the military-industrial complex and the Vietnam War that was being waged by the administration. So it was a important symbol that the anti-war activists in Madison decided they wanted to destroy. And so it was actually very, I talked to Carl Armstrong, who was the leader essentially of four students and former students at the time who bombed that building on August 24th. Leading up to that, which I think is important to know, in May, the National Guard in Ohio shot 13 students, killing four who were protesting peacefully against the invasion of Cambodia. So that had just occurred in early May. And as I mentioned earlier, students all over the country went on strike. In Madison, 84 Wisconsin students were arrested after conducting 20 firebombings. So there were, of course, in Madison, it was even worse than in a lot of other campuses. There were a lot of firebombings, and Governor Warren Knowles deployed 2,100 National Guardsmen to quell the campus revolt. So it was a very violent time, and there was a lot of protest. And then just before school started up again in late August, Carl Armstrong, his brother Dwight, and two other men who had worked at the Daily Cardinal at the time pulled a van up to the sort of drive in front of the Army Mass building, Sterling Hall. They had been watching the building for several weeks to see when people were there, when they were not. They had planned to do this bombing at a time when no one was in the building. It was about 2:30 in the morning, and the lights were on. They didn't really know that in fact someone was there, and they detonated a truck bomb that they had created. And just by learning from the Encyclopedia Britannica how to make bombs, it was a pretty rudimentary bomb. And unfortunately, they later discovered that a 33-year-old researcher named Robert Fosnock was in the building, and he was killed. He was a young father. He also apparently was against the war. So this is a terrible mistake and tragedy. And in many ways, people think that this tragic event was kind of the beginning of the end of the anti-war movement.
And I want to take a couple of our calls, Clara. So let's go to the phones. And Clarence in Watertown is up first. Hi, Clarence.
Good morning, or good afternoon, actually. Yes, August 4th, I left the United States for Vietnam to serve in the United States Army. I was drafted, and when the draft notice came in, I said, okay, I enlisted. And I couldn't believe, I knew that Madison was a hotbed of dissent and everything, and it was pointed out to me that a lot of these students are just little more than older kids. I mean, they haven't had jobs, paid taxes, held, responsible employment, and that. It just seemed to me they got away from home and they just went crazy with screwy ideas.
All right, Clarence, thank you for that perspective. And let's go right away to Janet in Milwaukee. Hi, Janet.
Hi. 1968 was the year that I graduated from high school. And there was no celebration at graduation because all of our brothers and our fellow male students were being drafted. And so we were very much against the Vietnam War. And I also remember the convention in Chicago. But to the point, we bought an old pie truck, and we outfitted it with mattresses and whatever things that we would need. We took a map, and we found all the universities that were protesting, and we went across the country protesting the war. We really felt strongly about it, enough so that we didn't go to college. We put up our own college so that we could protest that war. And so everything that you're talking about, I can relate to very.
And Janet, I want to ask you, because we're running short on time, how did you respond as someone who was part of the anti-war effort? How did you respond to the bombing of Sterling Hall?
Oh, I remember it very, very clearly. And I understood the reason for the bombing, but I also understood that, an innocent person was killed because of that.
And thank you very much for that call, Janet, and also for Clarence before her. And Clara, let's actually listen to a clip of current Madison Mayor Paul Soglin, who was a prominent figure at the time and one of the people you spoke with.
I felt that all of us on the left did have some sort of responsibility for what had happened, in that we had allowed what we called the crazies. We allowed them to take this too far.
And Clara, in just the minute or so we have left, Sterling Hall really did turn the movement, didn't it?
Well, did it? It also at that time, the movement was about a year, had about another year to go before it petered out. But it really was it was shocking to have killed someone by mistake. And it also proved that the violent part of the movement, the people like the Weathermen, also this group who bombed Sterling Hall, were not involved with the Weathermen, but there were many people who were very militant. And that is, as Paul Soglin says, the crazies, that they didn't really represent a majority of the movement. And they also hurt the movement because they alienated other people who might be, you know, sympathetic and were anti-war, but didn't want to be part of this fringe group. So as one person I talked to said, those sort of bombings really were the best thing that could ever happen to Nixon.
Clara, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Clara Bingham is the author of Witness to the Revolution, Radicals, Resistors, Vets, Hippies, and the Year America Lost Its Mind and Found Its Soul. You can share your memories of 1969 and 1970 by stopping by the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us what you remember and tell us where you were when these events were going on.
Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time on the Ideas Network.
If you have kids or grandkids, you probably found yourself cooking or ordering special foods just for them.
And just about any restaurant that welcomes families will have a separate kids menu that features spaghetti, chicken fingers, or maybe a hot dog or PBJ.
But if you travel abroad or know children being raised in other countries, you may have noticed that the U.S. might be unique in catering to children's limited eating preferences.
Joining us to talk about the concept of children's food is Gail Coleman. She's a specialist with the UW Extension Nutrition Education Program. Gail, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, when we talk about children's food in the United States, what are the most common things?
Oh, I tend to think about, you know, if I go to a restaurant, they've got fried chicken fingers or macaroni and cheese or maybe pizza, hamburger. Not a very varied menu.
And not a lot of fresh food, it sounds like.
No, it tends to be the things that are either sweet or maybe salty. Right, not a lot of the fruits and vegetables or things like that.
And you call children's food a modern myth. What do you mean by that?
Right. Well, it's really interesting when you think back to the early 1900s. That's when people that were doing marketing realized that if they marketed something specifically for kids or to children, they could really increase their sales on some of those items. And then, of course, when the media grew and the introduction of television and these messages were broadcast all over the country, the advertising really took off, and you started to see a lot more of, you know, toys or prizes in children, in cereals that were geared for children or snacks that were geared for children. And in restaurants, you started to see special meals or special menus just for children. So it really took off. And of course, now we have social media, and you see advertisements when you open up your computer, when you check your phone, things like that. So these messages are all around, and I think they've actually convinced a lot of adults that you need special foods, or there are certain foods that are specifically for children, and that's really not true.
Well, and I think that the idea is that kids won't eat the things that are that adults are eating or that the whole family is eating, but what is it like in other countries? Are we really unique in this?
Oh, that's a really good question. So when you think about over time, through history, and when you look at what people are eating in other countries, let's say it's a country where they eat a lot of spicy foods, the children tend to eat what the adults eat over time. I mean, young infants, of course, are not going to be
putting a Thai chili pepper in their bottle.
Exactly. But children really learn from their family members and their friends, you know, what are foods that they can eat. And the more they're exposed to these foods, the more their taste develops to appreciate the flavors.
What do you put that down to? Is it that Americans aren't cooking as much as, say, parents in France are, that they're not getting the education about food from an early age in the kitchen?
Well, it's probably a combination of factors, but I think the biggest things are marketing. I mean, really, advertising has a really strong effect. You know, if you see children's television, for example, you see a lot of ads for, again, very sweet foods, and those are the things that then the children are asking their parents for. There's actually a term for some of that advertising. It's called pester power, where the children will pester their parents to get to purchase something that they've seen advertised as fun, you know, maybe with cartoon characters or, again, prizes or sports figures or things like that. So that's a piece of it as well.
Is part of what we're talking about, this concept of kids' food and what kids will eat, kind of projecting that on kids, is that part of a broader American cultural factor of where we really treat kids as very separate from adults? It's not so much of a continuum, but it's like they're kids, they're adults, and you're treated one way when you're this age and a different way when you get to, say, 18.
Yeah, I think sometimes there is that mindset, but really, and this really goes along with tastes as well, children learn to become adults, or they grow into adults, and the same way with food, you know, they learn to like foods. If a child doesn't like a food the first time, that's pretty natural, especially if it's not sweet or salty, because those are flavors that are more readily accepted. But something that might be a little bit bitter or sour, it may take exposure to the food multiple times. Now, that's not to say that everybody's going to like every food. My son said to me when he was probably about 12, "Mom, you told me after I tried this broccoli at least 12 times I'd like it, and I'm still not liking it." So, you know, not every food appeals to every person, but people's tastes do develop. And if you think about maybe an example for yourself, I know I wasn't a coffee drinker when I was a child because coffee was bitter, but I love coffee now. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like I kept tasting it because I wanted to be more of an adult, and I wanted to learn to like it, and now I do. So our tastes can develop over time, and we need to expose children to the variety of tastes so that they do develop these tastes. And I'm not saying forcing. I mean, we really want to encourage children, you know, make it an adventure to try something new, make it fun to try something new. Maybe going into a restaurant, you're going into a restaurant, and rather than ordering off the kids' menu, maybe asking, you know, what would you like to try? And if it's something off the adult menu, maybe they're tasting something that you're eating because maybe the portion's too large or you want to split
the portion. Probably big enough to share.
Right. Or maybe, you know, they're ordering something like an appetizer that isn't as overwhelming for a child as far as size.
Is there anything different about kids' palates, the way that they experience the flavor of food? Or if we were just to sit them down on these kids' menu, there would be steak and lobster and lentils. Would they be just as likely to like those foods as an adult would?
There are some differences with children. You know, again, they have a natural tendency to like things that are sweet and salty. They see that even with infants, you know, if they give them something. But they will develop their tastes over time. And, you know, even with adults, their taste can change as well. I mean, when you think about some of the extremes, children are probably much more sensitive to taste, and older adults have lost some of that taste sensation. So things do change over time, and there may be some things that will appeal to adults more because they've developed those tastes, and maybe they want something a little bit spicier because they're not as sensitive to some of the seasonings.
We're talking with Gail Coleman. She's a specialist with the UW Extension Nutrition Education Program, and we're talking about the concept of children's food and what kids will eat and won't eat. So, Gail, we've talked about some of these big picture influences, marketing and other things, but what about in a family setting? Do children start eating only some foods, or do parents start only offering them those limited options? I guess I'm wondering what the dynamic is. Is there a chicken and an egg?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good question as well. Because, yes, there are a lot of parents that, you know, they want to please their child. They don't want to waste food if a child doesn't like it. But there are certainly things that families can do to encourage children to eat a variety of foods. I think probably the first thing is the expectation that, you know, these are the foods that we're having for this meal, and this is what you have to choose from. I'm not going to be a short order cook and make you a pizza if the rest of the family is eating lasagna or something like that. So that's one thing that can be taken into account. The other thing is, parents and siblings should really be role, or it would be good for them to be role models as well, because if parents aren't willing to try something different or eat certain foods, you know, children see that and they learn from that, well, if they're not willing to eat that vegetable, then I'm not going to eat it either. So being a role model, having the expectation that what's available for the meal is what everybody's going to be eating, those are a couple of the things that could be done.
Well, once a child has gotten used to eating those kids' menu items for several years, did the parents blow it, or is there still a chance for them to help their kid get out of that food rut?
I think there's always a chance. Kids go through phases as well. It's pretty typical that a toddler, for example, is going to be really hesitant to try new foods. And again, they think, you know, back in history, there's probably a reason for that, because once children are more independent and can be out on their own choosing foods, you want them to be a little bit more hesitant about trying different things because you don't want them to poison themselves or get sick. So kids kind of go through that phase. But then as they get a little bit older, you know, they might likes to be more adventuresome, or they might appreciate having something that's fun. So, you know, people can change their attitudes and their thoughts about things at any age.
I actually remember my daughter being quite young and trying olives, and, you know, like pretty heavily cured olives, and, you know, couldn't stand them. I think there might have even been spitting out involved. But she willingly tried them a couple of years later and ended up liking them. So mm-hmm. I think palates change, and also just what seems to be food to mm-hmm. them changes as well.
mm-hmm. Exactly.
We'll continue our discussion with Gail Coleman in a moment, but we also want to hear from you. Do you make different food for your children, or do they eat what the rest of the family is having?
If your child wants those children's foods, those very specific and limited foods, where do you think that those tastes and preferences come from? And do you have any advice and tricks to share for expanding a child's taste?
We hope you'll join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We're continuing our conversation with nutrition educator Gail Coleman about kids' food and why she says it's a modern myth.
And we want to hear from you. Do you find yourself making a whole different meal for your children, or do they eat what the rest of the family is having?
Were you a picky eater as a child yourself, and where do you think kids learn to eat just that limited option of mac and cheese and hot dogs from?
Join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or emailing us at talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We go to our callers now. We've got Tony on the line with us in Fenimore. Tony, hi.
Hello. In my family, growing up, we had to try whatever was on the plate. If we didn't like it, my mom had to at least make us try it once. And if we didn't like it, we were allowed to finish the meal but we couldn't have anything extra. We like dessert. If we couldn't have dessert, or if we didn't try that, we couldn't have dessert. But if we tried it, we could have the dessert. But basically, we had to try. And that was the biggest thing. And she knew that I hated peas. I still hate peas today. I'm 44 years old. I hate peas.
All right.
And but we had to try it every time.
All right. Thanks, Tony. Still hates peas, but he had to try everything. And that was the rule in their house. Is that a good rule of thumb? The one try at least? Or maybe it takes several tries?
Yeah, I think it's a good idea to encourage children to try something, but not force them to eat everything. I mean, because it might, again, it might take trying something multiple times. And a child might just kind of lick something at first or sniff it a little bit. I mean, they may not actually chew it, or they might chew it and then spit it into a napkin. So that, you know, that is a good strategy for parents to use. I want to comment on your pea example, though, because I will say I have learned to like peas, and there's a reason for it. When I was growing up, we used to have really overcooked canned peas, and that's why I thought, oh, these just don't taste very good. But, you know, I had to keep trying them. But as I got older and then I started to taste fresh peas and frozen peas, I realized that, you know, maybe it's the way that you prepare them or the way that you serve them or the form that they're in. So I was glad that I did keep trying peas.
I think that's a great point, because I think depending on how something is prepared, it can have a very different, not just taste, but texture. And so I'm not saying that Tony needs to run out and, you know, try 10 different pea preparations, but maybe there are, especially with kids, saying, oh, okay, you don't like that. Well, you know, maybe next week we'll try to roast that instead of boiling it or something like that, and encouraging them to not think of it as a black and white situation.
Exactly.
Let's go back to the phones, and Colette in Three Lakes is up. Hi, Colette.
Hi, I hope you can hear me.
Yes.
I think we're sort of coddling kids so much. My kids never really had a problem with trying different foods. Both my husband and I love to cook, and we're gourmets, and my husband was a chef, and they always just ate whatever food we ate. When they were babies, I just took the food we ate and put it in a blender, and they ate it. And I never made special meals for them. If they didn't like it, well, there's another meal coming up in 3 hours. Kids are not going to starve themselves. Eventually, they're going to eat. They're going to eat something. My sister took the other approach and was constantly making little meals. And her son is 16 now, and he will only eat cheese and bread, which is not never. And she doesn't bother her, but it bothered me. And we never made a big deal of it. Well, here we're having curried eggplant with couscous tonight. This is what we're having. And so they just eat everything now, and they're very adventurous eaters.
Thanks for that call, Colette. Gail, do you think, I mean, there must be some level of a personality towards being very timid about eating or being really adventurous, but the just setting up that expectation that this is what's for dinner, you know, you're welcome to have as much as you want or you'll be hungry, is that an okay approach to take?
That is true, and you're right. People have different personalities, and the same thing applies to with their food. Some people may be more adventuresome. Some people might be more hesitant to try something. They want to see if somebody else likes it first. So that is true, but yes, if you have that expectation that this is what we're having for dinner, this is what's available, children will eat. You're right. They're not going to starve themselves.
We're hearing about the advantages of cooking fresh and having home-cooked things, thinking about Tony's peas and your canned peas. Parents may like to put those fresh peas on the table, but canned peas are easier when you're strapped for time. So what do you do when you want to encourage your kids to eat different things, but you yourself, you know, you may not be able to get into that kitchen and cook that freshly cooked homemade meal?
Yeah, I appreciate the fact that there are challenges with time and priorities. I mean, you have working moms and dads that come home and maybe they want to spend some quality time just hugging their kids and sitting down and talking to them, and they don't have the time to make a home-cooked meal or something like that. Fortunately, we do have a wide range of you know, lightly processed foods and really healthy foods that you can choose from. Even you don't, it's still not limited to a handful of foods like fried chicken strips and pizza and hamburgers and mac and cheese.
So use some of them, but maybe not all of them.
Right.
Well, and actually that brings up a really interesting point, Gail, because it doesn't seem like it has to be an either or. Either we're spending time with our kids or we're cooking good meals. I mean, what role can helping kids understand how meals are made or even how vegetables are grown, how can that encourage them to maybe be a little more adventurous if they're actually taking part in the process?
Oh, that's a great, those are great strategies for encouraging kids to make healthier choices and eat a greater variety of food. I'm not saying that the mac and cheese and things like that are not healthy at all or anything. That's fine. It's just you don't want a steady diet of just a handful of foods.
Or as our caller said, just bread and cheese.
Right, right. So yes, getting your kids in the kitchen to help with preparing and, you know, if you're growing a garden and they're helping with growing the food, they are more likely to taste the food if they've helped to prepare it, if they've helped to choose it in the grocery store or maybe at the farmer's market, or they've helped to grow it.
And it seems like they're also gaining life skills that way as well.
Yes. And plus it's quality time with mom and dad and siblings.
Is there a good rule of thumb about how many times to present a food to a child before you say, you know what, he really just doesn't like peas?
I have heard that question before, and when you look at the research, I've seen a range of times. I think I've seen up to 30 times.
30 times.
But generally speaking, it's more like, you know, 10 to 15 times.
Well, that's still a significant amount of peas on a plate, though.
And some children, it won't take that long, but yes, okay. It could take a while.
And some, like our previous caller, it could be 300, and he's still not going to like peas. And that's okay. I mean, I'm a pretty adventurous eater, and I like a wide range of things, and there are just a few things that I don't like, and that might not change.
Yep, and there's nothing wrong with that.
We'll get you to like them, Judith. We'll keep presenting them. You can tell us what they are later.
No.
Well, Gail, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about how to get the kids to try new stuff.
Okay, it was a pleasure to be here.
Well, we are speaking there with Gail Coleman, a specialist with UW Extension Nutrition Education Program, and we've got a link to her article about children's food as a modern myth over on the Central Time Facebook page, so you can keep the conversation going over there. Tell us how your parents approached your diet, and how did it work out for you? Do you eat that variety of foods, or do you still maybe have more of a limited range?